There's got to be a better way to light up the world today. Something that we need, something safe and clean. Well, if you're searching, you can find the answer right before your eyes. It's atomic. It's atomic. There's no need to fear. We gotta let the whole world hear. It's atomic. It's atomic. It's atomic. And now, here's Rod Adams and the Atomic Show. It's atomic, yeah. It's atomic.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
This is Rod Adams, and it's time for Atomic Show number 94. And I'm really excited about today's chat. I have with me two of my favorite nukes, Hans and Mary Lou Gauger. I met Hans and Mary Lou probably in 1994 when I visited Penn State University and gave a talk about small reactors, the Adams atomic engine, and pebble beds. And I like to think that I had some influence on Hans's career because he specialized in pebble bed reactors and earned his PhD doing heat transfer analysis for pebble bed flow. Mary Lou is also a PhD and specializes, I think, mainly in waste and disposal issues. But anyway, Hans and Mary Lou, welcome.
Glad to be on your show, Rod.
Thanks, Rod.
And what I didn't say is that Hans and Mary Lou are in South Africa, six time zones away, and it's a gentle, civilized 10:30 their time, a.m., yeah. So it's not so civilized here at 4:30, but I generally get up pretty early, so I enjoy the opportunity.
So, and it's a beautiful late fall day in South Africa, sunny, and I'd say about 65 Fahrenheit, and it's been like this for about the past week or so. I'm told it's going to start getting colder now, but we're enjoying the weather as it is.
Fall is one of my favorite times of year, but here in Annapolis, it's getting closer and closer to summertime, so still not bad weather. Been a lot rainy recently. I had the roller coaster experience of landing on an airplane in a thunderstorm yesterday, and there were quite a few people that had a bit of a thrill. All right, so why are you guys in South Africa?
Well, as you mentioned, Rod, I specialized in pebble bed reactor core design and optimization. That was my graduate research topic, and it also took up quite a bit of my time as an engineer at the Idaho National Laboratory. And I find it a very exciting technology. Of course, there are only two places in the world that are seriously pursuing pebble bed reactor technology, South Africa, of course, with the PBMR project, and China. Well, I had been working on it for a while at the INL, but I decided after much conversation with Mary Lou that to really get into this and offer an alternative experience, we had to go down to South Africa and immerse ourselves in the PBMR. And I had been in contact and collaborating with a couple of South African engineers or PBMR engineers for a few years, and they invited me down to work in their nuclear engineering analysis group as a consultant. And I said, well, I have this issue. I have a wife and family too. My wife is also quite valuable, and trained. And they said, oh yeah. And we passed along Mary Lou's resume too, because she wasn't working specifically in the pebble bed field. So she was not as well known to them, but then they took one look at her resume and said, yeah, we can find a place for her too. Would you like to add anything to that, Mary Lou?
Well, I've been called a lot of things. I haven't been called an issue lately, but okay, I'll take that. Yeah, I'm here basically because Hans got an offer and was very excited about the technology, and I wanted to support him in this opportunity. And I thought it would also be an opportunity for me to expand my career in a different way, and an opportunity for our children to experience another culture. So I'm doing work, as you suggested, Rod, in the area of waste management, fuel cycle issues, but within that, in a very different area of research than I was pursuing in the U.S. at the Idaho National Lab and Idaho State University.
Both of our employers graciously granted us professional leaves of absence to come work in South Africa for a couple of years. Mary Lou is a professor at Idaho State University and also an adjunct engineer at INL, and I have been working full-time at INL since 1998. And they said, oh, we're sorry to see you go, but enjoy yourself.
And I'm sure that they're looking forward to you coming back with lots and lots of rare knowledge.
Well, that's what I hope to acquire here.
Well, that's part of the deal. REC, the leave of absence from ISU, and they said, we assume that part of the what we gain from this experience is you coming back with new expertise and some new collaborations for us. And that was actually part of what I made clear to PBMR in coming here. I said, look, you know, I'm a professor. I can't come and do something that I cannot publish. I need to publish or perish. I need to get tenure, and I want to create collaborations with the university, and they're very supportive of that idea.
Yeah, that's one of the things that you've been very interested in over the years, is in development of students and getting people really trained up, or educated, I should say, not trained, in nuclear technology. So I'm excited that you're still involved in that.
I am. I really seem to gravitate toward working with students, and I've recently been developing relationships with some what they call postgraduate students here, what we call graduate students in the U.S., guiding them in the work that I'm doing in conjunction with the University of Pretoria. So they are postgrads at that university and working through funding from PBMR on the project that PBMR has contracted the university to do.
I've not known many professors that, in my experience, that have Mary Lou's excitement and enthusiasm for working with students at all levels. And she is with her partner and director at Idaho State University, Dr. Michael Limeberry, really resurrected the graduate and undergraduate nuclear engineering program at Idaho State just on the basis of Mary Lou's energy and enthusiasm.
Well, that's, and I've always been excited by that enthusiasm. I think it's a wonderful thing, and I've met a number of Mary Lou's students over the years. And I think some of them still contact me and talk to me about various topics.
Sure.
So have you been keeping up with some of the developments happening in your home of Idaho, specifically a new employer coming to town?
Yes, we got wind of that through the nuclear grapevine emails, et cetera. I don't know a lot of the details, but that is a fantastic development for the Idaho Falls area and Idaho nuclear industry.
Yeah, it's quite the news in little Idaho Falls. I do still get my emails from the university, not from INL, but indirectly from INL when people forward me things. And I think the day this Areva announcement that you're referring to came through, I must have received this news forwarded from about five different people, from the university, from INL, from Hans. So it's definitely big and very exciting news.
Right, you're obviously talking about the plans by Areva to construct and operate a fuel enrichment or fuel fabrication facility. Perhaps you can fill in your listeners a bit.
Yeah, that's what I was referring to. recently, Areva, the French nuclear specialist company, announced that they would build their new fuel manufacturing facility at Idaho Falls, Idaho, just outside the area of the Idaho National Laboratory. It's a great choice of location because there's a whole infrastructure and several generations worth of nuclear trained people out there, and it's going to be about a $3 billion facility, so I'm sure Idaho Falls is excited about the opportunities provided by that. But let's get back to this South Africa thing. Tons, tell me, how is the PBMR project going?
Oh, well, I believe the sense I get in talking to the people, the CEO, a gentleman by the name of Yakub Creek, provides little staff feedback sessions, and we just had one a couple weeks ago, and he gave a little presentation on the project. He's rather upbeat about it, as he should be. The support within the country and the government in particular, but of course it's largely a government-funded operation at this point to build this demonstration plant. But the support does seem to be firm. There's a tremendous amount of interest from around the country, around the world. And the project is meeting schedule for the most part. They've had some delays in the past couple of years, which is to be expected with a large engineering construction project like this. But they are confident that they will be going critical in 2014, around there. They have spots in the queues for major components, which is really an essential requirement for keeping a construction schedule like this. If you can get a spot in a queue for a core barrel, reactor pressure vessel, etc., and maintain that with the manufacturer, then these long lead item things will come into place when you need them, and you'll keep going. So they still have that, and we're all confident that there will be an operating pebble bed reactor in the next 5 years or so.
So how does the pressure vessels that are associated with the PBMR compare to the pressure vessels that are being constructed for the large pressurized water reactors in terms of size and that kind of stuff?
They are comparable in size, if not a bit larger, certainly in terms of the volume within the vessel per megawatt. The pebble bed reactor vessel is very large, and there aren't too many companies around the world that can manufacture one of these. It also must be able to operate at a higher temperature. There's much more heat that passes out of the reactor core into the sink, at least during off normal conditions. If they lose their accident or their cooling, their vessel cooling, these vessels have to operate and withstand slightly higher temperatures because of the core temperature being high. But other than that, it's a pressure vessel steel.
And Mary Lou, what are you doing in terms of the waste? I guess the waste issues associated with the PBMR are significantly different than they are associated with the light water reactors.
Yes, definitely true. Some numbers that are tossed around that I've heard relative to volume are the PBMR will generate 16 times the volume of waste of a traditional PBMR. But that's not 16 times the activity. So what they're looking at is, well, a PWR has sort of small concentrations, or excuse me, small volumes of high concentration waste. The PBMR has large volumes of low concentration waste, because they have the TRISO particle fuel, which is only a 2 to 3 millimeters in diameter, encased in larger spheres of a matrix graphite material. So the pebbles that you hear about are these billiard ball-sized graphite spheres. The waste that we're talking about, at least that I'm working on, is not just the TRISO particles, which themselves are really small volume. It's the graphite that's large volume, low activity, and would quickly fill up any sort of repository, and also has some value in terms of recycle and reuse, because nuclear-grade graphite is pretty good stuff, especially when you've had all of the neutron poisons burned out of it in the reactor. So if they can get rid of the fission products and activation products, which are, again, low activity but spread through large volume, there can be a lot of economic and certainly political benefit to doing so. So we're focusing on some unique technologies to clean up the graphite and possibly recycle it, reuse it.
Well, that's a great thing, because that's something that, that's one of those urban legends on the internet, is that the pebble bed modular reactor fuel, quote, can't be recycled, which I've actually visited a manufacturing facility where they make pebbles, and the, at least the TRISO particles, and of course there's always rejects, and they routinely recycle the rejected particles and recover the uranium and put it back into the process. So,
yes, part of that common wisdom about high temperature reactor fuel is because the uranium, the recyclable heavy metal, is tied up and locked inside these TRISO coatings, which are very robust, and in fact that leads to its inherent safety. That's the primary pressure boundary in a high temperature reactor. There's a difficulty, with cracking that TRISO particle layer and getting to the heavy metal inside for recycling, but it's been done in the past, and it is certainly not out of the realm of our technology today.
Right. Well, it's robust, and certainly will never leak or crack based on the pressure of fission gases, but it's not indestructible.
Correct.
Right. Yeah, as you say, it's designed to be its own little pressure vessel. And so the question is, do you allow it to remain that little pressure vessel in terms of a waste form, which is probably a very promising path to follow, and then still recycle the graphite? Or do you recycle by crushing the little particles? And that's still an issue, I think, that needs to be addressed, whether or not the uranium is worth recycling if they get a pretty high burn-up. So you have, again, the issue of the fuel itself and the TRISO particles, and then the graphite, which is the large volume. It's a little hard to compare that to a traditional PWR, because the fuel is a little less dense with the ceramic pellets. So what would the graphite be? It would be sort of like part of the matrix material of the ceramic pellets, the cladding, maybe some of the structure in the core, the metal structure, that now is considered largely low level waste, some high level waste, and for those types of reactors.
One of the things that has always impressed me about the pebble bed reactor design is that the fuel does not need to be stored underwater once it is removed from the plant. It can be stored immediately in dry storage containers, at least for a while.
That's correct. The plan for the PBMR does have spent fuel accommodation for up to through 40 years of operating life of the plant. Takes the form of dry storage containers. There is a facility for a couple of containers which are wet storage. In other words, the canisters are surrounded and cooled by water, that's for the initial cool down period, which is not completely necessary, but it's doable, and it does buy a little bit of a safe operation too. So spent fuel that's discharged from the PBMR will spend a few months in wet storage to cool down, and then it's immediately after 6 months or so will be transferred to dry storage containers until recycling or eventual disposal.
Okay, but those wet storage containers are still dry inside, right?
Oh, yes. The pebbles themselves are not surrounded by water. They are in inside of a canister, the outside of which is cooled.
Okay. So, Mary Lou, your effort is with the graphite mainly right now?
Correct. They have a project. There's the way the PBMR company is separated by efforts is there is the DPP, the demonstration power plant, which is the demonstration reactor they're going to build and show proof of concept with. And then there are technology projects that are being pursued for future development of the technology that are not in the critical path of getting the DPP online. I work in this area of the technology projects. As Hannes just described, there's a plan for what to do with the pebbles when they have served their useful life in the reactor and they're put into a certain number of tanks. This is all part of the design of the DPP. But ideally, the graphite and TRISO particles will be separated. The graphite will be treated to have fission products, other radionuclides removed, and then reused somehow. Maybe not in the nuclear field, maybe in some other application. The particular challenge with the treatment of the graphite waste is, as I've mentioned, it's not terribly active, but there's so much of it. So, okay, how do you clean it efficiently of the radionuclides? Well, there are a lot of tried and tested ways to get rid of the non-carbon radionuclides. You know, chemical methods that have been used repeatedly for processing the fuel and cleaning of things, you know, solvent extraction, for example, in the Purex process, in the Urex process. So it's pretty straightforward how you would get rid of the non-carbon species. There's also even a lot of experience in the cleanup of various radionuclides and non-radionuclides using microbial action. Because certain microbes can reduce metal species to metal form and remove them from, let's say, an aqueous solution. What's a little more of a challenge with the graphite is how do you separate carbon-12 and carbon-14 isotopes? Because you're going to have a significant population of carbon-14 in the carbon-12 matrix, which comes from the activation of nitrogen impurities. And if you don't remove it, it becomes a bit of a hazard to reuse the graphite. So what do you do? Well, obviously, traditional methods of separating isotopes are a bit impractical with this huge volume of material. I mean, we have the gaseous diffusion, the gaseous centrifuge technology, but doing that, these huge volumes of graphite is just not efficient for given the value of it afterwards. So what else do you do? There are some mechanical, chemical methods that are being pursued that may be useful. But what PBMR especially is looking for us to pursue is microbial action, believe it or not. And when they first approached me with this idea, I really thought they were joking. You know, I'm a little more of a traditional chemist type, and I said, you're telling me there are bugs that distinguish between isotopes? Yeah, right.
Smart bugs.
Yeah, exactly. I thought they were pretty, I'd be pretty special bugs myself. But in support of my husband, I said, well, okay, I'll consider this silly idea. But actually, I've done some research a little bit before I came and since I've been here. And there is the phenomenon known as biofractionation of isotopes that's been known since the 1950s, that in natural systems, in kind of extreme environments like deep seabeds and so on, where groups of microbes will actually do the fractionation of isotopes through a series of processes. It's usually not just one type of organism. It's a combination of what they call a consortium of microbes that work together and over time will start to separate isotopes. Okay, so it's well established and it's in all sorts of literature, both from the 1950s and the earlier times to recent times. Now, application of that is more difficult to find in the literature. But lo and behold, there is a patent, as they say here, for enriching uranium using microbes. So I have studied that for a bit. I'm starting to understand the jargon of a microbiologist a little bit, and it can be done. Now, how efficiently it can be done remains to be seen. I have no evidence of application of this on a large scale, except for some anecdotal evidence. I work with a gentleman who is of Polish origin. He was a scientist in Poland and the former Soviet Union for a number of years before the Iron Curtain fell. And in his dealings with some Russian scientists, he claims to have visited a full-scale enrichment facility for uranium based on microbial action in Russia. But there is absolutely no written evidence of this because it was done in Russia during the time of the Soviet Union. So he is the one who started this whole idea at PBMR. He did some original experiments a few years ago, and I am essentially picking up where he left off to prove this concept in a more controlled environment and see what we can come up with.
Wow, that's going to be some pretty fun research.
It is quite fun, and it's getting me out of my traditional
comfort zone. Area.
Yeah, comfort zone and expertise, and it's kind of fun to branch out a bit. I'm working with students that have a background in microbiology and a little bit of chemistry, a little bit of mechanical engineering. And we're all learning together, so it's a lot of fun.
It sounds like it. Of course, my personal belief, since I'm a lazy cheapskate, is that the graphite that is left over from use as a matrix around nuclear fuel is probably the easiest market to address, is to use it as you're producing more and more pebbles from more and more pebble bed modular reactors.
Right, and that's actually a part of what could come out of this. The concern is, and in fact, this was discussed at some length at the meeting I mentioned earlier in our discussion, and I went to Jülich, a national laboratory in Germany, last week. That trip was to attend a meeting of the Carbo Waste Research Consortium. It's a European Commission Framework 7 research agreement, research collaboration. So it's really a European Union research effort, but they sort of are allowing South Africa to participate because South Africa has this unique position of getting ready to build a reactor and is planning ahead to look at the carbo waste. whereas the European countries are looking at legacy or current carbonaceous waste. In any case, two of the people or parties that were represented at this meeting are the two main graphite producers that create the graphite that is and will be used by these reactors. Now, of course, their initial thought of cleaning up the graphite, reusing it, is something they don't like, because that looks to them as competition for their business. But in fact, what PB DeMar is saying is, look, guys, we're not in the business of producing the graphite. You still will do that. We don't want that responsibility. What we're saying is we could provide you this nice feedstock for your process if we get it cleaned up. But they're not conditioned to take hot material to work with. They need stuff that's not hot. So, yeah, what you say is true. It would be probably good feedstock for making new pebbles, but it would be a whole different process for the manufacturers if it were hot material to start.
That's true. But my response to them is either figure it out or I will go into competition with you. But that's just me.
Yeah. Well, I tend to kind of agree with you, but currently PBMR is paying me, so there you go.
PBMR is the deployment of this reactor type, if you know it goes all according to PBMR's plans, is significant. And you start developing or building plants, you know, a dozen at a time for deployment in various developing and developed countries, and suddenly graphite source and resources becomes a serious issue.
Well, sure, because they're not going to be the only ones building pebble bed reactors and using graphite.
Right. That's right.
You know, not only the Chinese, but there's this tiny little company in the U.S. that really still wants to do that at some point.
And we're looking at them with enthusiasm and curiosity.
Yep. The comment that you made about the response of the graphite producers is something that, you know, has happened many times before. Of course, the reason that we only get about 4% burn up of our light water reactor fuels is partially because of the response of the uranium producers.
Interesting.
It could be. And the PBMR fuel, just to round that corner a little bit, they're planning to go to 8 to 10% burn up with it initially. But the graphite might be the more serious challenge here for that reason.
Yeah, you know, your friends here in the U.S. Recently achieved about 9% burn up using the UCO particle formulation.
That's correct.
Than the UO2.
Right. There are a number of interesting phenomena that occur in high-temperature reactor fuel as you go to higher and higher burn-ups, and the pressures inside the trisulfide particle build up. You get creep and you get different stresses on the particle layers. Some of these issues and challenges at high burn-up can be addressed and somewhat ameliorated using instead of straight uranium dioxide, you would go to a mixture of uranium dioxide and uranium carbide, and that takes care of the problem. But it doesn't have the pedigree, the large operating experience base of uranium dioxide.
Now, when people are doing the safety analyses, so far as I can tell, the only boundaries that are really considered are still just on the particles themselves. Isn't there a non-fuel cladding on the outside of the pebble that also helps to prevent fission products from getting into the environment?
You mean a layer on the exterior of the pebble?
Yes.
Not a significant one in the PBMR fuel design. It is just the graphite, the pyrolytic carbon layers, and then the graphite matrix in which the particles are embedded in. And that is, at least for the current burn-up targets, is adequate layer for adequate foundry for fission product retention.
Yeah, I think there's some sort of final coating on the pebble that is perhaps another form of graphite, but I can't recall the details at this point. But there isn't a sufficient, gaseous barrier or anything like that, like the silicon carbide on the trisil particles. In fact, one of the problems that is being planned for in the design of the reactor is the creation of graphite dust as the pebbles go through the reactor, because there's lots of interaction between the pebbles themselves and the pebbles and the walls of the vessel or the reflectors, so that there's a lot of friction and rubbing off of the surface. So, I mean, all that indicates right there that that's not going to be a great deterrent to the gases coming out. One of the things that we learned in Jülich, where the ABR reactor was built and still stands, was that they are in the process of decommissioning that reactor. So we actually got a tour of the facility, which was, you know, exciting for any nuclear nerd.
I'd love to do it.
Yeah, it was very, very interesting. In any case, so we toured that facility, and I actually took a few photos with my camera, so I can send those to you if you have a sort of posting for your listeners, Rod.
Ooh.
But they have built a structure on top of the containment building there, and they're using that in the decommissioning process. And the thread now to what I was saying before is that now that they've taken all the fuel out, they're trying to deal with the dust issue inside the vessel. And so what they're doing is they will be pumping into the vessel a very, very low density concrete, and they will pump it in from the bottom and let it flow up to the top, so that it pushes out any gas, and that will immobilize the graphite dust so that they can then take the vessel out of the containment building. They're going to sort of lift it up within the outer structure they've built, lean it over, and then take it out on a sort of a rail car for disposal. But they really, they've seen this dust, you know, in their process of taking out the fuel, and it is significantly active enough, certainly with carbon-14, but with the other, you know, the fission products and a few transuranics as well.
Now, my understanding of carbon-14 is it's not particularly dangerous to handle, just something you don't want to eat.
Yeah, it's a low-energy beta emitter, so I think it's more an issue of, again, the large volume of material and the relative then large quantity of beta. Yet, outside of you, it's not a bad thing because your skin will stop it being a low-energy beta. You don't want to breathe it in, and you don't want to otherwise ingest it.
Of course, I've got to learn more and more about carbon-14 because that's one of the challenges that Adams Atomic Engines faces in our nitrogen-cooled reactor design.
Yes.
Dealing with the material. I think it's a challenge that can be overcome because of the fact it's not a terribly difficult substance to handle, but that's something for a different show.
Yeah, but I'll comment on that because, you know, dealing with people at University of Pretoria, as I do for this project, they don't have a nuclear engineering program per se. They have chemical engineering, and they have an area that specializes in water treatment using microbial consortia. So that's where they sort of come into the picture, and I brought in the nuclear expertise. So I found myself having to explain some very basic nuclear things to the people there, like isotopes of the same element generally act pretty similar chemically, you know, things like that. So I bring that up because one of the initial ideas that one of the people there had for cleaning up the graphite of carbon-14 was, well, we know this great ion exchanger that takes carbon-14 out of things. And I'm thinking, let me see that reference. And what they were talking about was a couple of nuclear utilities that use a special ion exchanger to remove carbon-14 from reactor coolant water. And the carbon-14 was an activation product from nitrogen that was in the system. So it is not difficult to remove carbon-14 if it's the only source of carbon. But when you have it mixed with the other isotopes, it's a problem. So yes, your comment that it probably wouldn't be hard to cope with that issue when it's the only source of carbon, the carbon-14, is correct. There are lots of ways to do that.
Or as long as you don't mind mixing a little carbon-12 with the carbon-14, just as long as you treat it all as a potentially hazardous waste product.
Exactly.
Yeah, because separating carbon-14 from nitrogen seems to be a fairly simple thing from my limited chemical knowledge.
Yeah, it would be a purely chemical process as opposed to isotopic separation.
So how do your kids like living in South Africa? You said one of the reasons you went there was for the cultural experience.
It's been a challenge. The children are ages 9 and 11. My daughter is 9. My son is 11. We are, I think, reaching a point of some stability now. We've been here since December 31 of 07, so just really for a few months. And because the school year starts here in January, their school year runs with the calendar year, we were able to get here at the start of their school year. What we didn't know was things like, well, most of the public schools are fully booked, because when there was a change in the way the schools worked after the fall of apartheid, a lot of people that were previously going to schools that were sort of underfunded started saying, no, we want to go to this other school that's better funded, and then it was sort of on a first-come, first-served basis. So when we came to a particular area to live near where PBMR headquarters are, we learned too late that, oh, the school nearby won't accept us because they're full up. So that was the start of our experience with the children, and it sort of didn't get a lot better after that for a while. Challenges like, well, what grade do they go in? And you know, how do we equate that to the grades back in the U.S.? And
well, those were largely unmanageable issues. You know, we just had to become familiar with the system, understand the admissions process, et cetera, and we did get in. I think probably the greater challenge was the different educational style. The school system here is probably a little bit closer to that of the United Kingdom, and then with the enrollment being maxed out, as Mary Lou indicated, it makes the whole classroom environment very much different from what our children were used to. Expectations, schedules, et cetera, are all different, and that's quite a stressor for a kid to have to deal with. We kind of expected something would be different, but they've had to learn to adjust, and they have done so.
Yeah, they're fairly resilient, but again, you know, we had to figure out how to best support them. My concern for some time was, you know, this is going to end up being a traumatic experience for them, and they're going to look back on this period in their lives as terrible, and, you know, the parents abused them kind of thing by taking them overseas. But I think we've come around from that. I mean, they're, for example, getting used to wearing school uniforms and hearing all these different languages being tossed around at the school, and being a minority type in terms of their skin color and home language.
They are in an English primary school. That's the language of instruction. But all students also at this school are instructed in Afrikaans. And that's, since none of us are able to learn it, and most, or at least the white students here have grown up and raised on Afrikaans, and most of the instructors as well. So they're at a bit of a disadvantage, but the teachers are patient and very helpful, and the kids are teaching us a few Afrikaans words. Mm-hmm. It's a very unique language, very interesting language.
Well, it does have some mixture of Dutch and English, right?
Yes, it has a strong resemblance to Dutch.
I wouldn't say it has much resemblance at all to English, frankly. It's very, very. It's not even close to being Latin based. Yeah. It's much more Dutch, Germanic,
yeah.
and then you have the influences of the different peoples that, you know, develop the country. There's Malaysian and the different African tribal words. It's quite a combination, and you'll find that the typical black South African can speak two or three or four languages. It's amazing to a typical American who maybe can speak a second language if they're lucky. So you hear the typical black South African, you know, talking in English, they understand Afrikaans, and they'll speak it when they need to. They'll usually speak at least two of the tribal languages. And so they'll try one, and then they'll try another with somebody they meet just to see what works. But the country itself has something, I think, like 11 official languages, so you get a feel for the number of cultures about here.
And how about the living conditions for you and your family? Have you found a nice place to live down there?
We have. Where we live, it's the larger city in the area, Centurion, and that itself is a kind of a suburb of Pretoria, in between Pretoria and Johannesburg. If you pull out of suburban U.S. city somewhere and plop down here, you could hardly tell the difference. It's one of the more affluent regions of the area. We have a nice home that we are renting, a beautiful neighborhood, and shopping malls, rush hour traffic, the whole nine yards. You don't have to go very far to get into some rather poor developments, such as the townships, which are well known internationally. But here where we are in Centurion is quite nice.
We live in the Gauteng province, and provinces are akin to states in the U.S. And Gauteng province is one of the wealthiest of the country. So, you know, a lot of the industry and business in general is in this province, so you're going to find more of these upper middle class neighborhoods like we live in. It's probably not entirely accurate what Han said about you wouldn't be able to notice the difference between this and a U.S. upper. In terms of standard of living, that's probably true. But the differences you see are, well, most everybody has a pool because it's warm enough here for that. The foliage is what you'd find as house plants in the U.S. And more significantly, every house has a fence that goes the entire way around the property. It has spikes on top, or it has an electric fence. There's a gate, a remote-controlled gate that goes across the driveway. Every house has a security system, and if you don't live in a secure security village, you at least have a security service that patrols the neighborhood constantly. That is significantly different than the U.S., and it's a little bit uncomfortable for me still, and frankly, I don't want to become comfortable with it. I don't like the idea that I have to constantly be living behind a high fence with spikes on top or electric fence and be concerned constantly for my safety. And it is clearly a symptom of the poverty level in the country. You know, since the fall of apartheid, it's been, 14 years? 14 years. And, you know, it's going to take a while for the country to have a less of a gap between the haves and have-nots. There's a hugely growing middle class here compared to what there used to be. But there's still a lot of very, very poor people. And the more poverty you have, the higher crime level you have, it's just a typical situation, no matter what country you're talking about. And then you add to that the fact that South Africa is bordering some even poorer and more chaotic countries, and people are pouring over the border, coming here look for some security and some employment. We've had riots here, in fact, this week in a suburb of Johannesburg, one of the townships, where South African citizens, black South African citizens, have been targeting black non-South African citizens who are coming from Zambia and so on, because they feel that the foreigners are taking their jobs, taking their women, causing all the crime. It's, you know, typical xenophobia. So there are a lot of what I consider growing pains that the country is going through. Some of the growing pains I see, for example, at the workplace are the sort of affirmative action. You see that, I mean, it's rampant in the government, it's rampant in businesses where, you know, they're making a concerted effort to have the workforce be more representative demographically to the population. The population is the vast majority black. So they're looking to make things more equal. The problem you come to then is, in the last 14 years, has the level of education and training of the black population kept up with the demographics? And the answer in many cases is no. It's going to take some time for that to happen. So you have a lot of people in positions that, frankly, don't have the competency to be there. So, again, it's growing.
It sounds to me like you live in South Florida.
Perhaps.
Well, one should note, because news from South Africa doesn't, you know, travel very far to the U.S., permeate the, you know, the local conditions, et cetera. Since 1994, there has been a tremendous willingness and patience on all sides to make a go of this, to make this new South Africa work. There are troubles, yes, they have still a lot of differences and cultural clashes and uncomfortable situations, but they are resourceful people, and they are all determined to make this country a success, and they're on that path.
So tell me how you think the PBMR project fits in with that.
You know, that's an interesting one. The PBMR project started shortly thereafter, and shortly after the elections in 1994. And originally, it kind of grew out of some people within the previous infrastructure, the nuclear industry here, saw the PBMR technology, the pebble bed technology, as something they could adopt, something they can own and develop into world-class technology with a South African stamp on it. And they worked with the new government, and convinced the new government too that this is something that, that would be a symbol of the new South Africa. It's something that we could go for and do together. It's not, there may be some of the people left over from the old regime that are still in positions of prominence within the company. Because those are the only people at the time that were, they had the expertise, had that background in the nuclear industry. But, except for that, this is a multinational, multicultural, creative, dynamic thing that the South African government is behind. It's interesting to watch.
Well, what I kind of mean is that obviously one of the things South Africa needs desperately is more resources in order to allow that 85% of the population to move up to the standards of the 15% without doing the Zimbabwe transition where you take everything from the people that have and nobody ends up with anything.
Yeah, well, that's correct. And there's a positive feedback effect here. And now before 1994, there was a fairly modern and effective electrical infrastructure that was primarily grew up around the mining industry. It requires tremendous electric power to feed it. But they've got large coal reserves, and so between that and the mining industry, a very impressive electricity infrastructure was built in this country, an extensive grid. Of course, that kind of thing takes maintenance. These big coal plants and nuclear plants cannot be built overnight, as you well know. It takes decades, 15 years from conception to actual operation of a plant. That schedule was being followed by ESCOM, the state-run utility. They had effective resource planning in place at the time, but it was kind of shook up in 1994 with the change in leadership. ESCOM being a state-run utility, many of the leaders are political appointees. Maybe they didn't have the corporate memory of the previous regime in making sure you have a planning basis and you're planning for 10, 15, 20 years on out to bring new power plants online. Since 1994, or shortly thereafter, 1994, when ESCOM went to the government to say, we need permission to start building these new plants, the government said, no, we don't need it. We've got plenty of electricity. We've got the cheapest electricity in the world. We've got excess capacity, considerable excess capacity, and those the decision was made, no, we don't need any power plants. And since then...
And part of that decision was an attempt to privatize ESCOM. In the late 1990s, the government said, well, we think the utility should become privatized, so the government's not going to fund new plants. That should come from the private sector. Well, of course, the private sector wasn't willing to come forward with these huge capital investments at that time because they didn't see the need of immediate, return on that sort of investment. So,
and in as is becoming somewhat in the case with the U.S. as well, there's a heavy regulatory oversight of electricity generation in the country, and those new companies had no guarantee that they would be able to turn a profit on the plants that they built. So essentially, no plants have been built in a while, and finally, the excess capacity has dried up. Since 1994, a much larger percentage of the population has had access to electricity. They find out, ooh, this is great. Electrification is a wonderful thing. My life is better. I am more productive. And therefore, I want to go around and use even more of it. And my friends want to use it too. So their excess capacity has dried up. And in the past couple of months, we've undergone regular what what is termed load shedding here, which is in California they call it rolling blackouts whenever supply does not meet demand, which is currently the case.
It was in December of 2007 that the president of South Africa, Thabo Mbeki, admitted that, oh yeah, it was not a really good idea for us to not let them build new plants, was it? So, you know, they have new plants now planned, and they have some. I think the one that would come online newest, would be 2014. So they're looking at these rolling blackouts between now and then. I mean, this is a significant period of time. It's drastically affecting the economy. But in the meantime, they've had some of the mines and other large users of energy reducing their hours of operation, their general operations, which of course is affecting the economics across the country, because it's one of the major exports of the country. I remember reading something like 85% of the world's platinum comes from South Africa. I mean, it's a huge source of income for the country. So you put that together with the other industries that are affected by not just electricity, but the general offshoot industries from the mining. They're in trouble. And even though that's happened, okay, and, you know, we've had a slight pause in the blackout. So for May, for example, we haven't had any of the power outages. It's going to keep happening until they get some new capacity online.
Well, one of the reasons for the recent lull, interestingly enough, is the effect of this load shedding on their electrical infrastructure. Substations, the switchgear at substations and so on, really take a beating if you're flipping them on and off all the time. And this is what's happening. You know, they have a schedule of load shedding. You could get on the ESCOM website and see, okay, my neighborhood is going to be turned off on this date at this time. Okay, so they are planning to switch on and off the electricity to large chunks of the country at scheduled times, and it's taken a heavy toll on their infrastructure. And so they've suspended load shedding, and they've gone to some of the major consumers, as Mary Lou mentioned, like the aluminum smelters, and they have cooperated and said, yeah, there are places that we can cut back and keep things going, but that's only a temporary reprieve. There will be new load shedding coming on eventually, because the economy is growing and growing well. And as I mentioned, that the more people within the country that have electricity and use it, the more it's going to be a problem.
Well, they could also follow this California mode, which is essentially push all industry away.
Yes.
Call yourself energy efficient and simply import all your energy consuming material from somewhere else.
Except there aren't any countries around South Africa that can supply electricity. I think I could be wrong. I believe there are a couple of power plants in Namibia that they're looking to supply to the South African grid. But South Africa is a major electricity exporter for many, many years, and that's going away.
Right. Well, I'm not saying import electricity. I'm saying get rid of the aluminum smelters and the diamond mines and everything else,
right,
and then you'll have energy left for your population. You won't be making anything anymore, but...
Well, that's exactly what part of the controversy is now, that you know, some of the big companies that are planning on expanding or developing here are very reticent to do so now, and of course they are, because they can have no guarantee that they'll have the power they need, and therefore being able to make any sort of profit or even break even. And meanwhile, you know, in the late 1990s, there were government folks and ESCOM folks who said very plainly, look, if we don't do something now, if we don't build plants now, we're going to have this problem in 2007. And they predicted it, but it was ignored. So there's a lot of finger-pointing going on amid government and industry people. But the bottom line is, it doesn't matter now, does it? They need to get their butts in gear and develop some capacity, and they're going to have to deal with the ramifications in terms of the economy, and it's not pretty. Everybody will keep working and keep growing, like Han said. It is true that the people here are very positive and hardworking, and they want things to work. They want the country to do well. But the constant challenge is the level of incompetency in some of the decisions that are made. The government, I don't know what percentage of government officials either have been or are currently under investigation for criminal activity, and it's just nuts. You have these components of third world countries mixed intimately with the components of first world countries, and I never know which it's going to be from day to day, depending on the circumstance. I just scratch my head a lot.
Well, I hope you don't lose your hair.
I'll keep you posted.
Those kind of challenges are definitely, it's almost like a canary in the coal mine, though, because the U.S. has had similar reluctance to build new power stations for very similar reasons. You know, people thought we had plenty of capacity, and we did for a while. But, you know, long-term thinking is not something that's well rewarded in the electrical power industry.
Well,
if it's not properly structured.
And it's not well rewarded by the government. There has been a tremendous increase in the regulations that the power plants must adhere to. And when you've got regulatory oversight that limits the amount of profit you can take, you're not going to get investors to take the kind of risk and build a big power plant in your country to get over that. So there is no incentive to look in the long term. And it's unfortunate that it is happening in the U.S., but it's happening all over here as well. Like you say, this is kind of a test case, a harbinger of perhaps of things to come.
Well, it's hard. I've been trying to get investors for a long time, but it's hard to find somebody who wants to invest in a plant in order to keep the prices low.
Right.
That just doesn't make economic sense to somebody.
Right.
Unless you are in a regulated rate of return environment.
Right.
So, hey, I've had a great time talking to you all, but I'm sure that you have things to do on your Saturday morning. I hear some children in the background who may be getting hungry or something, or ready for mom and dad to come talk to them.
But, we have bribed them with chocolate, Rod. We told them if they behave during this exchange with you, we'll feed them chocolate afterwards.
Ooh. I thought you were going to bribe them with the pool.
Well, yeah. You might have heard my son remark that it is cold. Yeah, the temperature is not quite enough. It's probably more like lake temperature than warm.
Hey, why don't you let them come over and say hello?
I'm sorry?
Can they come over and say hello?
Yeah, I'm sure they can.
They would love to. Actually, Charlie's been here a few times while we're talking, and we shoot him away. Hey, Charlie.
Come on over, Charlie.
Okay. They're coming.
He didn't notice.
He sounds like a light-footed individual over there.
That was the two of us at the same time.
Uh-huh.
Hi.
Hello, Charlie. How are you?
How did you know? Now that stinks.
Now, I've known your name for years.
Yeah.
Okay.
He knew you when you were a little bambino.
Yes.
I think I still have pictures of you when you were a very tiny baby. Your parents and I have known each other for a long time.
Yeah, yes, you do.
And then the other one just snuck in up here. Betty, do you want to introduce yourself to Rod's audience?
Okay. Hi.
Hi,
Betty. My name is Elizabeth. Betty for short.
Hey, Betty. How you doing?
Fine.
Now, how do you like living in South Africa?
I don't think it's quite as good as America, but I like it so far.
Okay. Now, you, when you were in America, you lived in a small town. Are you still in a small town?
Not really. It's huge. Pretty much.
It's a big suburb between here, between Johannesburg and Pretoria.
Yeah, so we're kind of in the middle of highway speed traffic.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so I hear that you're learning some new languages. Can you say hello in Afrikaans?
Ashe. Well, that's so to you, idiot. No, we haven't been able to establish that one yet. So.
Well, they know how to say things in, what, Zulu?
No, in Sotho.
Sotho?
Sotho, one of the eight languages. Say, hoi mora.
That's good morning in Afrikaans.
Okay, in Afrikaans you would say, goeie mora, that's good morning. Or goeie middag, for good afternoon.
Middag.
Yeah, you have to make sure you clear your throat with every G. And there,
Roll your R's. Roll your R's.
There's a common, I don't know if it's Zulu, is Yebo? Is that Zulu?
No, that's Sotho.
Sotho, they say Yebo. And that means everything from hi, how are you, to yeah, sounds good, okay. It's multi-purpose.
Sort of like aloha.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, what else have we learned from, what have you learned from Daisy?
Not much.
Ashe?
Shop.
Yeah, Ashe. Ashe is a hello in Sotho.
Oh, Ashe is hello in Sotho. And Shop. Shop is that Sotho?
Yes.
Shop is Sotho for okay.
Fine.
Fine.
Great.
See you later.
Yeah, they have a lot of all-purpose words.
Yeah, and Daisy is a lady who comes to work at our house every day, and she does work around the house, and she also collects the kids from school at the end of the day. Daisy is Sotho. And it's one of the things that we've learned. We've never had somebody come and work in our house, you know, that we paid to come work in our house like this. But it's one of those things that you're sort of expected to do when you make a decent salary in this country, because there are so many people who rely on that kind of work to survive. So we pay her to do those things, and she comes and works hard, and it's wonderful. And she
likes the kids, and like kids like her.
Yeah, she works with the kids, and they like her a lot. And she teaches them how to say funny things and so too.
This is a new experience.
Yeah,
in regards.
A very interesting experience.
At the present moment, I'm actually staying at school until 5 o'clock.
Yeah, Charlie sleeps. It's a long school day.
Yeah, but
wow.
Well, that's worth it. I do my homework.
When do you do your homework if you don't get out of school till 5?
I just do. There's this thing they call aftercare. It's essentially just it's a thing that you just go and do your homework and just walk around the school forever.
The school day actually ends at about 1:30, but he stays back and works on his homework and plays chess and plays soccer with his friends until 5 o'clock.
There's a program that one of the teachers supports to help his children get their homework done and that sort of thing.
Great. Well, Charlie and Betty, thank you very much for joining us. Hans and Mary Lou, thank you so much. And Mary Lou and
yes.
Hans, we need to do this again sometime.
Yes, we could maybe give also just shorter up versions that you can slip in, just updates on the situation here or particular topics that may interest you or your listeners. But we've enjoyed it immensely, and we'd love to be back.
I've enjoyed it. It might be interesting, Rod, to do this again when we return to the States and reflect back on the experience.
Well, we'll do that, but we're certainly not going to wait for a couple of years before we have you back. So.
Very good.
All right. Take care.
Thank you.
Thanks, Rod. Bye-bye.
There's a way, such a better way. Today. Raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. Today, there's a better way. Ooh, there's a way. such a better way today, today. Now raise your voice, tell the world there's a better way. The way is the Adams way.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.